www.thebrainfarm.com.
Time now is 3 o'clock, and you're listening to a Juno Afternoon on KTOO for Wednesday, September 18th. I'm your host, Lisa Fu. We'll find out about this weekend's 50th anniversary celebrations for the Glacier Valley Baptist Church. Megan Coyle, Jenny Monroe, and Jesse Knudsen will be here to highlight this Saturday's Wild West party. We'll get a preview of tonight's Juno World Affairs Council meeting with guest Dr. Steve Fabes, speaking on six continents on one bicycle. And Ruth Olson will give us an update on the activities at the UAS Student Rec Center. That, Writer's Almanac, music, and more, all on today's Juno Afternoon. First is National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. First Nations canoes took to the waters in Vancouver, British Columbia Tuesday to launch Reconciliation Week. The event is put on by Canada's Truth and Reconciliation Commission. It provides an opportunity for former students of Indian residential schools to share their experiences with the commission and to help educate Canadians about the country's 150-year history of residential schools. Today through Saturday, public dialogues, panels, walks, prayers, and film screenings take place. The event is the sixth of seven mandated by the 2007 Indian Residential School Settlement between the Canadian government and former students. Residential school survivors are talking about their experiences at the schools, including physical, emotional, and sexual abuse. Technology may help reverse the decline in the use of Aboriginal languages in Canada. As Dan Karpinchuk reports, a First Nations software developer created a language app for smartphones and tablets.
Derek Baxter is the president of Ogeekie Learning Systems in Manitoba. He created the app so his daughter could learn Ojibwe. It's also seen as an aid for the next generation of First Nations to learn the language and keep the dialect alive. It has worked so well that Baxter has put it up on iTunes for free, and in a year and a half, the app has reached more than 20,000 downloads. Winnipeg University professor Lorena Fontaine says many First Nations communities are trying to bring back the languages of their ancestors. But Fontaine says this should not be relegated to individuals or pockets of activity. There needs to be more involvement from the Canadian government.
There needs to be constitutional recognition that Aboriginal language rights exist in Canada, and that there's guaranteed funding by the federal government to help revitalize Aboriginal languages.
Once downloaded, the program is designed to work offline so users in remote communities with poor internet services can still take advantage. The aim is to have the app in Ojibwe classrooms this year. Baxter says he's already been contacted by the Ontario Ministry of Education. Baxter says he plans to release a Cree version of his app soon. He's also been contacted by communities in Finland, Taiwan, Australia, New Mexico, and South America. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
One of the nation's largest tribes is reporting a significant economic impact in Oklahoma. As KGOU's Kirk Gortney reports, the Cherokee Nation is breaking business records.
A new study shows the tribe based in eastern Oklahoma had a $1.3 billion economic impact on the state during 2012. The report says the Cherokee Nation government and business operations directly accounted for more than 8,000 jobs and an additional 1,160 contract employees. Cherokee Nation Principal Chief Bill John Baker says the tribe broke all records in production output, dividends, and the number of workers. The chief says the tribal business umbrella, Cherokee Nation Businesses, continues to diversify and broaden its portfolio. Baker says a strong Cherokee Nation means a strong Oklahoma, and the tribe is doing more than its share to grow the state. The report was conducted by an Economic Research and Policy Institute at Oklahoma City University. For National Native News, I'm Kurt Gwartney in Oklahoma City.
New Mexico U.S. Senator Tom Udall says he'll help his state with federal recovery efforts. Tribal communities were among those hit hard by heavy rains last week. Udall says damages need to be assessed first. He says the Federal Emergency Management Agency is in the state this week seeing if a federal declaration is needed.
I'll be here to support any federal disaster requests by the state and tribal governments. Tribes now deal directly with the federal government on disaster declarations. They follow the same procedures as the state, and we're working closely with all of them to make sure they get what they need.
Some tribal communities in the state reported problems due to flooding after the record-setting rain. During this week in 2004, the National Museum of the American Indian, or NMAI, opened on the National Mall in Washington, D.C. NMAI is dedicated to the culture, art, and history of Native peoples throughout the Western Hemisphere. The museum showcases a vast collection of Native objects spanning thousands of years. This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation, and by the law firm of Sanosky, Chambers, Saxe, Miller & Munson, advocating Native American interests throughout the United States, with offices in New Mexico, California, Alaska, and Washington, D.C. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
You're listening to a Juno Afternoon on KTOO. I'm your host, Lisa Fu, and right now we have Martha Penrose and Vic Lemer in the studio right now, and we're going to be talking about the Glacier Valley Baptist Church, the 50th anniversary celebrations, which is really exciting. So how are you both involved with the church?
Well, I've been there about 21 years, and I teach an adult Sunday school class. In the past, I worked with children and just attend regularly and love it.
My dad moved here in January of 1972, and in June of 1972, the rest of the family came up here, and we started going to church there and Vacation Bible School, big familiar thing with me. And then more recently, my wife taught there at the Valley Baptist Academy, which is a pre-K school. She taught there for 10 years. Then we help out with a youth group called Awana. I've been doing that for about 9 years. So just been a great church to be a part of here.
So you both have been involved with the church for many, many years. And the celebration is a 50th anniversary. Can you speak to some of the changes that the church has gone through?
Well, maybe just telling how it started.
Sure.
In 1963, two families who were in downtown Juneau, the population then was about 12,000, and they said that there were 1,000 in the valley didn't have a church. Mm-hmm. And so they felt a need for there to be a church in the valley. And they met in July, and in August they had their first meeting in someone's home. And then in September, they dedicated themselves to a church and started looking for property. And it was interesting because the person who was involved in seeking the property came in excited that he had found a place, 2.77 acres of ground with a two-room house on it. And so they had to figure out how they could afford it. They kind of negotiated with the seller and got it down to a $1,500 down payment. So they all went into their savings and got the money together and signed a $15,000 agreement and had their church. No heat and no water.
But there
no
was
bathrooms.
A roof. There was a roof. That was important.
There was a roof, and they had a little fireplace. So that's where the church started in 1963.
And it's in the same location?
Exact same location, but we've added to it.
Just a little
bit. Okay. Mm-hmm. So the building itself has changed. I presume the congregation has grown as well in the past 50 years?
Of course, it started out with 16 people,
right?
And it has grown. But just like all of Juneau, it fluctuates simply because people, when they retire, they move to a place where they can have cheaper expenses. And so we have a fluctuating population within our own church.
Okay. So it's definitely a great reason to celebrate longevity, 50 years. Are there other reasons to celebrate this great occasion?
That's a good question. Well, the church itself is a mission-based church. In the New Testament, Jesus' last words were, go out into the world and teach. And I think this church, among several of the churches in Juneau, are very good about equipping people and sending them out. I've been sent out several times within Juneau, but I always find myself drawn back to Glacier Valley Baptist Church. It is a great family feel, but we see, you know, we're going on two and three generations later, people are in China and in Russia and South America. But there's always families that come back. We have a thriving Coast Guard family that comes in, and I really love Coast Guard people, but I dislike them because they get in our hearts and then they move on after 3 to 4 years. But the time that they're here, we our family expands. We have great new relationships, and that's the thing that's lasted all these years is that relationship, and that's what it's all about.
So it's a full schedule of events. I saw it online. It starts Friday evening, goes until Sunday evening. Do you want to talk about some of these events?
Certainly. The kickoff, like you mentioned, is Friday night. This coming Friday night, September 20th, there's an open house, a meet and greet, where a lot of individuals that have been here in the past that have moved away and others that are here still in the capital city are all going to come together and kick off the weekend. A breakfast Saturday morning, a lunch Saturday afternoon, but the really big event is Saturday night with the 50th anniversary party. It's going to be music, presentations. Former pastors will be there, a video presentation, just a lot of memories to go back over again. And then the last events on Sunday, there's a breakfast, a lunch after church, and then Sunday night will be a recap and stories, and the missionaries will be taking over Sunday night to talk about where they've been.
Okay. Are there folks traveling to Juneau for this event?
Yes, there are.
Okay. That's great. And are these events just for current members?
No, we're hoping that people even here in Juneau are in outlying areas who were with Glacier Valley in the past but moved on for various reasons, their location, maybe the age of their children, different things caused them to move to other churches, and we're hoping that they will come and celebrate with us. We have a tremendous number of ministries from the church. A family came up from Haines a few years ago who won, not from Haines, from Lower 48 to Haines to start a church. And we sponsored a church, and they this year built a building, which is great. And as Vic mentioned, we've sent teams of young people to Slovakia and to Guatemala, and they've gotten the feel for missions, and they've gone there to help with summer ministries to children. And in Slovakia, they've been teaching English. So that's been a great opportunity for our young people.
And they'll be giving presentations?
Yes.
Okay, that sounds really interesting. You talked about that former pastors will be attending. How many pastors has the church seen in the past 50 years?
Well, there's a website that lists most of the photos that we have. Would you say 12 to 15?
It would be hard to say because a lot of our pastors have come up from the lower 48 and have had family issues with health, and so they would only be here a few years and then would leave. So we've had a number of pastors, but we've had some wonderful interim pastors also. There always is someone there, whether it's the regular pastor or the fill-in pastor, and they all have had this same wonderful mission attitude so that we reach out to the community. We have a jail ministry at Lemon Creek. We serve at the Glory Hole once a month. We go to the Pioneer Home. We have a wonderful program for the end of October whenever the kids are out on the street. About 300 come to our church, and we have wonderful booths and bouncy houses. And so there are many opportunities that we can reach out and serve here in our community, and we do.
So how should people join in on the celebration?
Well, they can contact the church for more details. There's more. The posting, like you mentioned, is on our website. If you just do a Google on Glacier Valley Baptist Church or even GVBC and put Juneau in there, because I discovered there's a GVBC church someplace in Georgia. So if you do that, you'll find the link for our 50th anniversary. And by the way, congratulations on K2's 40th anniversary coming up.
Thank you.
It's another big celebration and amazing what K2 has done in locations. And we've stayed in the same place, but it's always changing. And then also I have a phone number for the church. If you'd like to contact Jody, her number is 789-7348, and that's the church secretary, Jody Buck, 789-7348.
Okay.
There's a Facebook page, too, by the way, specifically for the 50th anniversary.
And for folks who might not know where the church is, can you give the address or where it's located?
I think everyone knows the little red church that's on Mendenhall Loop Road just after you pass,
Floyd Dryden?
But it's a little red church on the left-hand side as you're going toward the glacier, right before you get to Taku Boulevard.
Right. There's an intersection with a light there just before you get to that. On the left-hand side, there's a kiosk, a sign that talks about Glacier Valley Baptist Church, and usually there's some saying in that, but that's where we're located.
Okay. So this is for current members, former members, possibly even new members?
Well, and people, any people of the community. We've had, the school has been there since 1980, and so we have a lot of people who were only kids who now are adults, and I'm sure they would like to come back and celebrate with us also.
Great. Okay, and the first event is Friday evening. At what time is it?
I don't have a time.
Okay.
Maybe Martha has, but I would presume 6 o'clock probably.
Okay, and the big event is Saturday night.
Saturday night, yes.
Okay, well, thank you so much, Martha and Vic, for coming on and telling us about the 50th anniversary celebrations for Glacier Valley Baptist Church. Up next, we have Writer's Almanac.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Wednesday. It's the 18th of September, 2013. The birthday of Samuel Johnson, Litchfield, England, 1709. When he was 26, he married a widow who was 20 years his senior. An intelligent woman, he decided, and around the same time, he also started writing. He wrote essays, he wrote a play. His most productive period was his 40s. He wrote 200 essays for the newspaper The Rambler, and he wrote his Dictionary of the English Language. And in his 50s, he met young James Boswell, who was 22, who followed him around, took notes, and later wrote the biography, The Life of Samuel Johnson, which made Samuel Johnson one of the most quoted authors in the English language. Johnson said, "Patriotism is the last refuge of a scoundrel." He said, "When a man is tired of London, he is tired of life." And he said, "A decent provision for the poor is the true test of civilization." It's the birthday of the French physicist Jean-Bernard Léon Foucault, born in Paris, 1819, took the first clear photograph of the sun, helped develop a technique for measuring the velocity of light with accuracy, and is best known for his pendulum, Foucault's pendulum, that demonstrated the Earth's rotation. It was on this day, 1851, the first edition of the New York Times was published in a little office just off Wall Street, founded by Henry Raymond and George Jones, who wanted to put out a serious paper, not a tabloid. And it was on this day, 1837, that Charles Louis Tiffany opened a stationery and fancy goods emporium on Broadway, New York City, which became Tiffany and Company. Here's a poem for today by Bert Kimmelman, Old Age Home. The ride from Manhattan, slipping her into the passenger seat, swinging in her legs, shutting the door, to the suburbs of New Jersey, its trees and freshly painted houses, was as neat as her empty apartment. We placed some photos on her table, hung up a few paintings on the walls, arranged some of her sculptures here and there, plugged in lamps and the television set. We made our way along the hallway to a room full of sun where people were gathered to talk a little, though she had nothing to say. There was a stereo playing music, and once in a while someone sang the lyrics, which had returned from some dim region. A man seated in an easy chair had wanted years ago a girl just like the girl who married dear old dad. We went to dinner. Someone poured her a glass of juice. She ate, spilling food with a sudden hunger. Afterward, we sat on some couches. Someone asked her to dance. The music played. She danced with slight, tentative steps, a tulip too heavy for its stem. When we had to go, we kissed goodnight and left her to lie down in her soft bed, her head on her pillow, to slip into sleep. A poem, Old Age Home, by Bert Kindleman, from his collection Gradually the World, New and Selected Poems, published by Blaise Vox Books, and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac. Supported by the Poetry Foundation, publisher of Poetry Magazine, committed to discovering great poets and printing their verse. Back issues and subscriptions available at poetryfoundation.org. And by LendingTree, where you can fill out one form and receive up to 5 loan offers at trylendingtree.com, NMLS1136. Engineered by Noah Smith and produced by Joy Biles, be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
That was Writer's Almanac, and you're listening to A Juno Afternoon. I'm your host, Lisa Fu, and right now we have 3 lovely women in the studio right now to talk about the Wild West Party taking place on Saturday. We have Megan Coyle, Jenny Monroe, and Joe Wolfenstein. So let's first talk about the event, Wild West Party, Saturday night. So who wants to start talking about the event?
Well, we're going to host a Wild West Party at the Red Dog Saloon, and our whole goal with our fundraising projects is to partner with local businesses, and so this time we're partnering with the Red Dog to help promote the fact that they're going to be open this winter. So they have a new winter menu debuting October 1st. They're going to have a pool table and just have a really great time all winter long for all the locals. So we're trying to help get the word out there that they'll be open this winter.
Okay, so Wild West Party, should people be dressing up or...
Definitely. We're going to have a costume contest, so you can come dressed as a cowboy, a saloon girl, a pioneer, your favorite Native American. We're going to have a poker game, roping, lots of drinking games involving beer and prizes.
I think we're going to have a duel, too.
Yeah, we're having dueling with little cap guns.
And what time does this event start on Saturday?
The event's at 9 p.m., and it will go until people don't want to be there anymore. We'll just party through the night if we need to, or bar close. Yeah, and we'll also be featuring shots of whiskey that evening, and we get a huge percentage of every whiskey shot that is bought that night, or sold that night, I should say, to go straight to our project. So come and please drink whiskey.
Just like in the Wild Wild West.
Right?
So can people just arrive at Red Dog Saloon at Saturday evening? Do they need to buy tickets beforehand?
Tickets are being sold in advance at the Flying Squirrel.
Jack.
And the Jack.
Or you can contact me. My number's all over the flyers, or I'll announce it. I don't mind. It's 907-612-1551. And you can also pay at the door, so there are several different ways.
Okay, so this sounds like a really fun event. Costumes, some role-playing, some good drinks.
Oh, and live music. We have 2 different performers performing live Western music the whole evening.
So dancing as well.
Yeah.
Okay, but it's also a fundraiser for Groundwork Opportunities. So I just went on the web. One of the missions of Groundwork Opportunities is to help provide access to clean water. So how will the money raised on Saturday night help to do this?
So we are raising money to purchase a human-powered drill. So the problem is we don't have enough money or resources to drill all of the wells they have need for in the Masaka district in Uganda, which is where our project is based. And so by purchasing a drill for them to have, for the local leaders in that country to have, will allow them to drill all those wells and bring fresh water to nearly 1 million people. And contaminated water is a huge issue in any third world country, really. But in Africa alone, there are nearly 4 million people that die every year from contaminated water. So it's a staggering number, and we're attempting to reduce that.
How did the three of you get involved with this project, helping to fundraise for it?
Well, Joe can talk about how she initially got involved. I think she did a lot of research about groundwork opportunities, but she's my best friend, and she's been a huge influence on me, and I wanted to not only help her, but bring about the realization that anybody can make a difference in the world on a grander scale by acting locally. So that's how I got involved.
I met Joe last year through work and attended one of her previous fundraisers, and her passion was just contagious. You know, she's just an inspiration, and so it just inspired me to get involved and become a champion of groundwork opportunities myself.
Yeah, Megan just launched actually her own sort of mini campaign within the overall perspective of the drill, and so she has her own little campaign going on and will be hosting some of her own fundraisers, I believe, this winter to help raise money for it. So she's definitely been really great for us. And then Jenny is just the workhorse. She is always a part of every single one of my attempts to raise money. She's just always there to lend a helping hand or to help me with flyers because I'm computer illiterate, or even as simple as, hey, will you go to this meeting with me so that I can have, you know, a second opinion. So both girls have just been totally invaluable this whole entire process, so it's really a blessing to have them.
So raising money for this drill for help to bring clean water to villages, is this the first fundraiser that you're holding for this, or have you held other events?
So my fundraisers in Juneau last year were all to go toward building a sustainable pig farm in Uganda, and this drill will be an addition to that. Essentially, we're raising money to give this, or to buy this drill and give it to Peter, the owner of the farm who runs our pig farm in Uganda. And this is our second fundraiser going toward the effort. Our first was last month. It was the 1920 Speakeasy Party, which was a smashing success. And that is actually the only reason that the Wild West mm-hmm. Party is happening this month. We just, by popular demand, were requested, please throw another party. Please do more events. And so we just thought, oh, okay, let's rally and let's do one more before the summer's over. So this is our second event going toward this project.
There are a lot of other folks who are working towards the same goal. Because this is a rather large effort, I think $30,000.
Well, $45,000 all told together.
Is what you're trying to raise.
Right.
$45,000. Okay.
So there are people actually all over the country that are fundraising, and even internationally that are fundraising for these drills, and everybody's kind of playing a part. My best friend and I are pretty seasoned fundraisers or champions at this point, so our goal is $20,000, and then Megan is just getting started, so she has a smaller goal in mind. People all over have goals of all different sizes and shapes, and they go about it in different ways, but all of us collectively are trying to raise this amount of money for freshwater.
So the money that you that this event is helping to raise money for, is that going towards one specific drill, you said, for this pig farm?
Yes.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And does that serve a community, a school?
It will serve an entire region. So we'll drill eventually 150 wells with it for an entire district in the country of Uganda.
And 100% of the proceeds go to groundwork opportunities. So
they don't take out administrative fees or anything like that. The people involved all have other jobs, you know, to make money, but this allows them to put 100% of the proceeds toward the effort.
And when you donate online, they give you the option to donate toward groundwork opportunities itself, as well as the
efforts.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so do you want to refer people to some sites or anything, get more information about the cause?
Yeah, so if you want to go learn about the organization, which is by far the most amazing organization in all my years of researching nonprofits. They jive so well with what I believe. we need to be doing and the way that I think we should go about it. But their website is groundworkopportunities.org. So feel free to check them out, check out their different projects and what they have going on.
Okay, I think folks in Juneau are always looking for ways to give. This is an easy way to give because you can have fun at the Wild West party, buy some drinks for your friends, dance, have fun, and know that all the money is going towards groundwork opportunities for these freshwater drills. Thank you, Megan, Jenny, and Joe for coming in and talking about it.
Thank you.
Okay, right now I'm going to play a track from Hot Club of Cowtown.
Softly shining on an old Kentucky home. Fragrance of magnolias filled the air. A lonely girl was writing to her sweetheart all alone to say how much she wished that he were there. Silver dew on the blue grass tonight. How it shines in the moon's silver light. The days that used to be, how I wish that you could see silver dew on the blue grass to the one that loves him so. Star of love, high above, shining bright. Silver dew on the blue grass tonight. How it shines in the moon's silver light. And in the days that used to be, how I wish that you could see silver dew on the blue grass tonight.
The Hot Club of Cowtown on Juneau Afternoon. I'm your host, Lisa Fu, and right now we have Dr. Steve Fabes and Jim Clark in the studio right now. Welcome, you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So we have a very exciting speaker for tonight's Juneau World Affairs talk. And Jim, I think you wanted to talk a bit about the Juneau World Affairs Council.
Well, the Juneau World Affairs Council is a nonprofit, nonpartisan group interested in world affairs. We bring people from all over the world to come and speak, and we have very interesting speakers, and I think you're going to find, and I would invite the public to come, it's free. It's the Egan, what do you call it, the Egan Room.
The Egan Room
at the Centennial Hall at 5 o'clock this evening, and again, it's free, and we think people will be very interested to hear Dr. Fabes.
Okay, so Dr. C. Fabes has been cycling for 3.5 years, has ridden over 30,000 miles through 43 countries on 4 continents, and now you're in Alaska. So your trip is more than just a bicycle ride. Is that true?
That's right, yeah. I started 3.5 years ago. I left from London. I cycled down across through Europe, the Middle East, the length of Africa and the Americas. But on the way, I stop and visit remote medical clinics to gain a bit of understanding about how the neglected tropical diseases are kind of targeted on the front line. So that's the kind of the extra element, I suppose, yeah.
Okay. So tell us about how exactly the journey started.
I cycled in South America quite a long time ago with my younger brother. I was only 19 at the time. We cycled through Chile, and that really sowed the seed, I think. I wanted to travel more. I wanted more of an adventure, and I had this kind of nagging idea of maybe doing something a bit bigger, cycling around the world. But I was getting on with my medical career, and then eventually it came to a head, and I thought, I need to make a decision, and I decided I have to go for it. I don't want to get old with any regrets. This has to happen. So I over the course of 2 years, I made plans to get going, and I set off on my bicycle, and that was 3.5 years ago now. Been okay. Cycling ever since.
And where did you start?
I started in London from outside the hospital where I was working as a doctor. I waved goodbye to my friends and my family from there, and I took off through Europe, through a very, very cold Europe. It was the coldest in 30 years, in fact, so I hadn't planned it very well from the beginning. And then when I crossed Europe, I came into the Middle East. I actually had to return briefly to the UK for surgery on my knee. And when I got to the Middle East, I was there in the summer, so I kind of messed that up as well, which was very hot. But I got through the Middle East into Africa, and then I cycled down the east side of the continent.
The east side, okay.
Yeah.
And so you're in the midst of your journey.
I'm in the midst of the journey. I'm about two-thirds of my way through. So next month I plan to fly to Australia. And from there, I'm going to cycle across up the east coast of Australia, and then through Indonesia, and then all the way through Asia, back across Europe again, and home. And I think it's going to take 5.5 or 6 years in total.
Okay, so as I said before, you've been to 43 countries so far on this particular journey.
That's right.
And so how many more do you intend to go to?
Oh, it's difficult because I haven't, you know, planned the route in any. The route's not set in stone, so I'm not exactly sure how many extra countries they're going to be. At a guess, maybe 25 or 30 more.
Okay, yeah. Wow, okay. And how many continents do you want to go through?
So 6 continents. The aim of my journey was to cycle the length of 6 continents. So far I've cycled the length of 4. So Europe, Africa, South America, and North America. So I've just got Australia and Asia left.
Okay. And so I think the burning question on everyone's mind is, why are you doing this?
It's a question I get asked a lot. It's actually quite difficult to answer. There's lots of different reasons that fed into it, I think. I think initially it was just the yearning for a big adventure. And I'd always had a passion for travel. I wanted a new challenge. I was looking forward to living a fitter, healthier life, and also a kind of simpler, less complicated life as well, which you get on a bicycle. So there was lots of things, and I've grown into the journey as well. So what I've really enjoyed is honing a new set of skills, and I really enjoy photography. I really enjoy writing about the trip. I enjoy speaking about it. So there's lots of other things that have come kind of stemmed from that as well. And on top of all of that, there was this desire to try and publicise something that I felt strongly about, and that was the issue of the neglected tropical diseases. And if you come to the talk tonight, I'm going to focus in on my experience visiting some remote medical clinics in Africa, and that's something that I think an issue that I think deserves a little bit more public attention.
Okay, so what are considered the neglected tropical diseases?
So they're a group of 14 infections defined by the World Health Organization. That some of them people might know, others perhaps you haven't heard of. Some they've got very long and complicated names. They're medically quite diverse, but they're grouped together by the World Health Organization because they occur in the same areas. They occur pretty much exclusively in conditions of poverty. So when we talk about the tropical disease, people think in terms of the big three, which is HIV, AIDS, malaria, and tuberculosis. Actually, most people working in this field think it should be a big four, that these neglected diseases, these 14 diseases as a group, are probably just as important as the other three problems as well. So as I said, they're medically diverse, they're mainly parasitic infections, and they're a huge burden. 1 billion people worldwide affected, so that's 1/6 of the Earth's population.
Okay, and what is the status of them as you're traveling through these countries? How is the international medical community doing in terms of eradicating them?
Getting there, I think. They're getting a higher profile. For years, they've been neglected. They haven't had the attention that they've deserved. Mainly, I think, because they affect poor people, people with very little political voice. These are infections that don't travel very well. So there hasn't been much attention. There hasn't been much effort to eradicate them until more recently. I think the good news is that we have the potential to eradicate a lot of these infections. So more work is being done at the moment, and there's some real progress being made.
So what are you seeing, for instance, in these remote clinics in Africa? Mm-hmm. What do the clinics look like?
I mean, mainly they've been mobile medical clinics. So in very remote parts of Africa, especially when you're dealing with nomadic populations, if you build a hospital, people aren't going to be around for very long to use that. So you have to go to them, and that's the point of these mobile clinics. So in some parts of Africa, I was able to visit these mobile clinics and see up front the doctors and nurses who are working, who are affiliated with NGOs, working to treat people, and not just for these neglected tropical diseases, for all kinds of problems, including malnutrition. But the neglected diseases was a real focus because it's a big problem, especially in more remote areas. And one of the reasons it is a problem is because not much money has been invested, especially in for drugs to combat tropical disease. There's not much financial incentive for pharmaceuticals to develop drugs to target them. So that's another issue, I think, that needs to be addressed. Yeah.
So you're going to these clinics. You're like, hey, I'm Dr. Steve Hayes. And you're observing them for a few hours?
Yeah, I'm just observing, really. I'm a medical doctor, but I'm not working in a professional capacity. My role is to observe, is to learn. It's for my understanding, really, to increase my understanding of how things are being tackled on the front line. And I'm able to then speak about that and try and help raise the public profile of these neglected infections and the work that's being done to combat them.
Okay, so as you're doing your journey, you're speaking about it. Is there a bigger plan for your observations when you get back home?
Yeah, I mean, tropical medicine is something that I've got a professional interest in. I think it's difficult. There's not many jobs in tropical medicine in the UK, as you might assume, but it's difficult. I don't really know what my career direction is going to take when I get back. Certainly, all of this experience is going to be useful for me professionally and something that I'm going to be able to take on and use in my career. But whether I'll specialize specifically in tropical medicine, I can't really say at the moment, so we'll have to see how things go.
Okay, and so part of your journey is not in the tropical world, for instance, right here.
Yeah.
So this is just part of the bicycle part.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, this is that's something that I do when I'm in the right parts of the world, but other than that, I'm moving through on a bicycle, and I'm traveling and writing about it and documenting the journey through video still photography, and then making presentations. And I often speak in schools as well, and the aim of that is to try and encourage kids to travel, to embrace adventure, and I talk about how important that is to try and get kids outside and seeing the world as well, not being reliant upon what they hear necessarily on the television or whatever, but to go out and see places for themselves.
Okay, so you said part of your goal was to live a simpler life. When you're traveling by bicycle, you only can carry so much. So what are you packing with you?
I mean, that's exactly what I like about traveling by bicycle, is that you have to narrow things down and you have to take exactly what you need, because every gram counts. And when you're cycling up a mountain, your mind's going to be thinking about all those things you don't necessarily need. So I'm carrying basic stuff. It's stuff that enables to camp. So I've got a stove and some stuff so that I can cook. So stuff that I'm self-reliant, basically. And then I've got a few clothes, some tools to fix the bike, a small medical kit, and then a couple of what I'd describe as luxury items. And those are things that I need kind of brain food for the evenings, because cycling doesn't take any brain power at all. So I need books, and I always carry a couple of books, and an iPod as well, so I've got some music to listen to. So they're kind of my luxury items, I guess.
Okay, and you're documenting this. You have a blog,
yeah.
Cycle the Six.
That's right, cyclingthesix.com. Yeah, that's the number six, Cycling the Six. And there's lots of information on there. I love to write about my journey. So if you get on there, you can have a little look, get a bit of background for the trip. Hopefully people will come down tonight and see the presentation.
Yeah, your writing's pretty prolific. So you have your laptop with you?
I do. I bought one when I crossed the border into the States. Yeah.
Oh, okay. And then where are you staying during your artist journey?
I sleep anywhere I can is the short answer to that. And I sleep for free at least 7 out of 10 nights. I've slept in various places. I usually rough camp by the road. That's kind of my normal I cycle as far as I can, and then I find somewhere to put my tent, not necessarily in a campground, just wherever I can, because I'm trying to save money. I have to live quite cheap. But local people very often invite me in. In every country in the world, I've had local hospitality. I've slept in schools, police stations, churches, mosques, monasteries, army barracks. I've slept in a shed with a water buffalo. I've slept in all kinds of places. So it's just, I'm just opportunistic, really, because I have to be, because I'm traveling for so long that I've got to live on less than $10 a day. So that's kind of how I do it.
Less than 10 US dollars a
day?
That's
right. I mean, and sometimes significantly less than that, especially in Africa and Asia and South America.
On average, how often are you showering a week?
not as often as I should. I think my record is 11 days without a shower. But usually, I mean, when I've been cycling through Alaska, I can just jump in rivers and stuff, and it's really cold. But it's just, if that's my only option, then that's what you just have to do.
Okay, and, you know, you're going on this huge journey. You have a lot of time to think. Mm-hmm. You're meeting lots of folks. You're learning a lot. What is something, you know, that you didn't think you would learn about the world, about people?
I think, generally speaking, places are never as dangerous and as scary as people would have you believe. And a very common theme of my journey is that I'd get to a place and people would say, "Don't worry, you're safe here, but be careful about the next town or village. There's bad people and they'll rob you." But you get to the next town, lots of hospitality, but they say the same about the next place. So this happens all the way around the world. I've grown to trust people, and I got a little bit numb to these warnings of these bad people around the corner, because I haven't met many. And 99.9% of people have been very kind, hospitable, generous. And that's been the recurring theme of my trip, really. The defining feature is just the generosity of people I've met along the way.
That's really great. And just for folks who are listening right now or who go to hear you talk tonight, is there something that we can do? We're not riding our bikes through six continents. Is there anything we can do to help with the cause of eradicating neglected tropical diseases?
Well, I think you can go online, go on the World Health Organization website, and find out a bit about the issue. Obviously, there's not enough time now to talk fully in detail about it, but I think there's a lot of good information out there. There are various NGOs that help to tackle the different diseases specifically. And I haven't listed the diseases, but there is a charity that looks specifically at schistosomiasis, which is one of the infections. I think if you go online, there'll be links from the World Health Organization website. You can go to my website as well, and they've got a neglected tropical disease section on there, so you can find a bit more information.
Okay, and then what are your thoughts about Juno?
I love it. It's really, I really like it so far. I've just got here. I've just arrived, just flown in. But it's such a dramatic place to come into. And I've already gone down and seen the glacier. And it's really kind of mind-blowing at the moment. So I've really enjoyed myself so far.
Great. Well, thank you so much for coming in, Dr. Steve Fabes, Jim Clark. Dr. Steve Fabes is talking tonight at 5 p.m. in the Egan Room at Centennial Hall, part of the Juno World Affairs Council season. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Everybody knows his name. He said there's no doubt about it. It was a myth, the fingerprints. I've seen them all, and man, they're all the same. Well, the sun gets weary and the sun goes down. Ever since the watermelon, and the lights come up on the Blackhead town. Now somebody says, what's a better thing? Well, it's not just me and it's not just you. This is all around the world. Out in the Indian Ocean somewhere, there's a former army post, abandoned now just like the war. And there's no doubt about it, it was the myth of fingerprints. That's what that old army post was for.
the sun gets bloody and the sun goes down, ever since the watermelon, and the lights come up on the blacktop town. Somebody said, what's the better thing to do? Well, it's not just me and it's not just you. This is all around the world. Over the mountains, down in the valley, lives the former talk show host. Far and wide, his name was known. He says there's no doubt about it. There was the myth of fingerprints. That's why we must learn to live alone.
That's Paul Simon on A Juno Afternoon. I'm Lisa Fu, your host, and right now we have Ruth Olson with us in the studio to talk about the UAS Rec Center. Welcome, Ruth.
Welcome. Thank you.
So what's new at the Rec Center?
Well, I've been at the Rec Center for a year. I'm the new Recreation and Intramural Program Coordinator, and kind of just making some changes and offering more opportunities for the students in the UAS community. And so we're kind of making the rec center into a true gym. We're opening up at 6:30 in the morning till 10 o'clock at night, Monday through Friday, and change their weekend hours to 11 to 8, versus before we were only opening at 8 o'clock and it wasn't allowing them to work out before like a typical day. So we changed our hours to open up for the clients and the students. And we've offered memberships for a lot of people. They're like, well, how do I become a member? And if you become alumni and friends, if you're at the community and you're not a student, faculty, staff, then you could pay a $100 platinum membership, and then you then become affiliated with university and are allowed to get those affiliated rates, which are really good rates that we've got. And we offer monthly, semester, and annual rates for memberships. And then once you're a member and can come and join, we've got tons of new activities that we've got going on.
Okay, so before we get too far, first, so some of the listeners who aren't aware of what the Rec Center is at UAS, what sort of facilities are there?
It's a joint-use facility. We're basically, the upstairs is with the Alaska Army National Guard. It's a joint facility. And then the Rec Center is focused mostly downstairs. We've got a gym with multi-purpose. We've got basketball lines, volleyball lines, badminton lines. We've got a running track upstairs. It's a 14 or 17-lap track that's indoor track. Kind of a carpeted floor to give you a little bounce. Cardiovascular, we've got the Precors, ellipticals, Star Treks, the bikes, the rowing machines, the Le Mans bikes, kind of your typical, you know, workout exercise equipment. And then downstairs we have a climbing gym that's an astronomical. It's like 30 feet tall with about six different routes that you can climb, you know, free climb. We've got a slack line in there. So it's a great little gym environment. We've got a big screen TV. We show movies in there and kind of just get that rock climbing environment. We've got a dance studio that we offer a lot of dance classes. We'll be talking about the salsa dancing and the Zumba dancing that we'll be offering in different dance classes that are offered also through the university as just recreation credit classes. And then we also have the weight room that's, you know, a full weight room with, you know, the typical, I think we have 23 weight machines of weights plus free weights.
There's a lot going on
there.
There's
tons going on there, yeah.
Okay, so what sorts of classes or events are going on there that people can get involved with?
Well, we offer monthly events that we do each month that's an ongoing type deal. On Monday nights, we have a climbing gym open house from 7 to 10, and that anybody can come in. They could pay the $5 guest fee, and they get certified to climb on our wall. And then once you're certified and basically approved that you know our commands and how to climb and our rules and regs, then you can come in anytime we're open and climb, which I told you the hours were opened up, so that gives them their. The second Tuesday of the month, we do knitting night. It's kind of just sit together, socialize, pull out some light snacks, kind of knitting is the big thing as you're sitting in class or something, and, you know, you want to learn a new stitch or somebody, you know, is working on something. It's kind of neat just to socialize and kind of a little socialization group. One of the big things we've got is salsa dancing that we do twice a month. We do it on the second and the fourth Thursday, and we do salsa dancing. And we try to get an instructor kind of that comes and volunteers the first hour just kind of for somebody that no experience required, just kind of come in and learn the basics. And then, like, the last hour, we'll crank the music and just kind of dance and have a good time. So we do salsa dancing. Tomorrow night is the first month we're going to do board games and card nights, and basically whatever the in-board game is that we're going to, you know, play, or cards or whatever, just, again, a socialization to bring the students together, a community together, and play and recreate and leisure activity versus just the physical. We also we have a great facility. We do a first Friday each month.
Mm-hmm.
We're in the process. I can't remember what band we've got. We've got a local band that's going to start playing, and we feature one of the student artists or up-and-coming artists kind of in the, it's called a SAC, the Student Activity Center, where we've got a huge dance floor and band, you know, stage, and then we have artists that kind of do their show on the side. So it's kind of a neat little thing based on the first Friday. And then this Friday coming up is the third Friday of the month. We have an open mic night, and that starts at 8:30, and it's just kind of coming, you know, poems, poetry, you know, what you've got, band. We've got some musical instruments. We've got the drums and things like that. So it's just coming out. Again, it's, we're trying to bring everybody together and play and recreate.
And you said there's badminton courts?
We've got badminton court, badminton, basketball, and volleyball. We play indoor soccer. Basically, we set it up that on Monday nights we do indoor soccer. It's kind of geared toward soccer. On Tuesday night is a basketball night. On Wednesday night is volleyball. On Thursday is a dodgeball. And Friday is kind of a miscellaneous. On the weekends, we'll put up the volleyball net, usually in the afternoon, like at 1:30. So we kind of just open the gym up. And when I say these times specific, usually there's always a court available to play basketball or just come in and recreate. You know, if you're not wanting to participate in those, just come and play.
But anybody can join those.
Anybody can, yeah. It's open rec. We have a guest fee for $5 if you want to be a guest of the student, faculty, and staff and come in for $5. Or like I said, you can get that great membership. It's a alumni and friends platinum membership for $100. And then a community member could get a membership too. So,
anybody in the community. You
pretty
don't
much anybody.
Have to be...
People think, oh, I'm not alumni or I'm not affiliated with the university. It's called Alumni and Friends, and as long as you're a friend of the university by paying that just $100 platinum fee, then you become a friend and affiliated.
It seems like there's lots of great things to do at this rec center.
There are tons of great things to do.
The classes, the gym, sports. Do you find that the rec center is utilized well?
We're working on it. I've only been there for a year, and I think it was underutilized. People, you know, last year were like, there's lots more people in here. And I'm like, fantastic. That's, you know, that's what a gym's supposed to be. So I think we're starting to get that community and that it's a true gym and membership and socialization and a place to go and play and recreate.
Okay, so how can people start going to the rec center, get a membership? What should they do?
Well, you can go online to the uas.edu/rec, which is our website, and we have everything there under memberships. Again, if they're not affiliated, then they need to do the alumni and friends, which we can also there do at the rec center or online at ours. Or they could go to the alumni association and become, you know, go through them, and they'll send you in the right direction and give everybody what they need. So they've got a couple different opportunities. So we can go on the internet. They could call in, and we could just take credit card and, you know, information over the phone if we need to, and, you know, get them going. So there's many opportunities for them.
And if folks do want to come and play badminton or basketball, there's equipment there.
Yep, we pretty much have everything that you supply. And if somebody's like really got, you know, some people like their basketball or whatever their, you know, racket is for badminton, they're more to, you know, bring them in as long as they're safe and we're good to go. But we have all the equipment for checkout, basically with some form of collateral, and we're good to go.
Okay, great. Well, thank you so much, Ruth, for coming in and talking about the UAS Rec Center.
Great, thanks. Thanks for the opportunity.
Listening to a Juno Afternoon on KTOO. For tomorrow, Thursday, Shona Strausser will be the host. We'll talk with Kathy Well about the changes at Night Moods. We'll get a preview of Sunday's concert dance with the Hot Club of Cowtown, who we're listening to right now. Bill Mark will be here to highlight Friday's Poetry Slam. And William Todd Hunt will be here with an update on Opera to Go. And Nancy Duterney will be here for Arts Up. That, Writer's Almanac, music, and more, all on tomorrow's Juno Afternoon.
This is KTOO Juno. We rebroadcast on translators K276 AF in the Mendenhall Valley and Auk Bay, K269 AO in Lemon and Schweitzer Creek, K201 AM in Gustavus, K220 BT in Hoonah, and K210 AS in Excursion Inlet and Icy Strait. In Juneau, KTOO is on GCI cable on digital channel 871. We're also online at ktoo.org. Support for national programming on KTOO comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and listeners like you. Stay tuned for All Things Considered.
Listen to our colleagues over the course of the last week. We have a plan that they're happy with. We're going forward.
Speaker of the House John Boehner's latest plan to pass a spending bill and appease the Tea Party caucus in Congress. It's Wednesday, September 18th.